Hello, folks, and welcome to another episode of On My Mind. I'm Shelley Griffith, and today I'm delighted to have as my guest the Executive Director of the McMinn County, Tennessee Living Heritage Museum, Brett King, who's fairly new to our town, but getting settled in beautifully, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Shelley. I appreciate you having me here. This is a great opportunity, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
We really enjoy having you with us, and I've enjoyed visiting with you before this, and we'll look forward to many more. But start out, as we do with most of my guests, kind of where you were born, raised, some early family.
Okay, certainly. I was born and raised in, technically born in Durham, North Carolina, but raised in Raleigh. Grew up there. My family-wise, I had got a father and mother, of course, and they started a chain of used bookstores when I was about 6 years old. Funny enough, my dad used to work for IBM, and he came home and quit one day. Told us why, because IBM made a bad business decision in leaving the personal computer market and selling the program to some upstart company called Apple. So he decided to start a chain of used bookstores. But I say that as only to, as I was young, I started working for him. Working in a bookstore, you're surrounded by reading material. So from a very young age, I became a voracious reader, which will play into my education a little bit later. But yeah, I graduated from high school in Raleigh, and I had an older brother. I have three brothers, two older and one younger. Everyone's still living. And he joined the Air Force, and he came home from basic training one day and wanted to show me what the Air Force was like. So he put me in his car, and he drove me out to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, mm-hmm. and we sat on the flight line, and I watched fighter jets take off all day. Oh, wow. And as a 7-8-year-old kid, I said, that is what I want to do in the rest of my life. So ended up graduating high school and then getting accepted and attending the United States Air Force Academy. So went out there in 1992, and 4 years later was graduated with a bachelor's degree in history. Went off to get married. My wife Heather, she's with me here in Athens, and we got married about 3 weeks after graduation. And then a few months after that, I entered pilot training in Enid, Oklahoma. And a great place to fly because it's flat, and learned how to fly there. Following that, we went to Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane, Washington, where I flew air refueling tankers. While I was flying tankers there, about a year into it, the Kosovo War kicked off mm-hmm. in the Balkans. And I got a phone call one night to pack my bags and prepare to deploy in the morning because we were going to go over there and support the air effort flying air refueling tankers. Flew over there, spent about 4 months, basically across Europe, got to visit, spent a lot of time in France and Germany and a little bit in Spain, flying missions over there. And I remember one night we were sitting up in a tanker orbit, and we had fighters coming in and getting gas and going off and hitting their targets and that kind of thing. And I was a young 26-year-old co-pilot, and I looked over at my aircraft commander. His name was Woody. That was his call sign. And I said, Woody, I'm curious, what's a Kosovar Albanian? And why are we over here helping them? And he looks at me and goes, I don't know, Brett. You like to read? Go read about it. We landed, and I went and got a book, and I read all about the history of the Balkans and started getting fascinated with kind of the international relations aspect of it, how the different countries interact with one another and how that can lead to conflict, and particularly being in the military, how that can involve all of us in the military in those kinds of events. After I left there, I left Fairchild, got home from the conflict, went to Scott Air Force Base in Illinois to work for Air Mobility Command. And at night, they have classes, on-campus classes on the Air Force Base. One of the schools was Webster University, based out of St. Louis. So I applied to start taking master's classes in international relations. And it was predominantly as a result of that conversation. You never know what experiences you're going to have, at least it was so in my case, that are going to lead you down a certain path. So we spent 2 years there. By this time, I'll back it up a little bit, because you can't talk about your military service without talking about 9/11 a little bit. Yeah. We got back from Kosovo, and my wife and I had decided that we were going to wait a little while before we had children. We were still young, and we traveled a lot, and I was gone a lot to begin with. And so we decided to wait about 6 years before we started having kids. And after I got back from Kosovo, we were talking about it. So this is probably a really good time to start having kids. We just had a conflict. Chances are I'm going to be home for a while. And things have quieted down is what was my guess. And on September 11th in 2001, we get a phone call in the morning from her mother in Michigan saying, yeah, turn on TV, see what's happening. So I get up and I turn on TV and I'm watching the tower on fire and then thinking to myself, what a beautiful day. How does an airplane hit a big building like that? And then saw the second plane fly into it. And you knew that everybody knew at that point what was going on. So I walked back in and told my wife, who was about 3 months pregnant with our first child. Again, the unexpected in life is something I pay attention to. And everybody has it. You have to adapt to it and do the best you can out of it. So went over to Afghanistan about 3 weeks after the attacks. We were over there commencing the air war. Came home from that and then finally got the job over at Air Mobility Command a little quieter. Two-year command staff position, so I wasn't going to be deploying. And as soon as I got over there, we started planning for the Iraq War. So I was on staff doing basically logistics planning, getting all the aircraft over there. We ran an air bridge across the North Atlantic with hundreds of tankers stationed from the East Coast of the United States to Iceland to Europe, getting all the airplanes and everything in place for that. That was an interesting experience. I got a front row seat to it. Got to see things happening in real time that I knew we had planned. And so it was a heady time for a young 30-something year old man. After that, ended up transferring over to C-17s, cargo planes. Went to Charleston Air Force Base. Now, we'd had our second son by now. In Illinois, our second son came along. Went to Charleston Air Force Base, flew C-17s for a while, was in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan a lot during those 3 years. And decided we needed a break. It was getting a little bit too much for the family. I was able to get a job back at the Air Force Academy as a commander of a cadet squadron. I went back to my alma mater and got to command the cadets that I once was. That's a good way to put it. And things started to slow down for us tremendously, and we liked it. Kept the kids in school. We weren't moving around quite as much anymore. And then when it came time to go back to flying, I was able to weasel my way into the academic side of life, and the Air Force agreed to send me off to get my doctorate in political science with a concentration in international relations is what I was planning on doing. So I went off to the University of Nebraska for 3 years, got my doctorate, came back to the academy and taught for the next 5 years. 2 years from retirement, I thought, okay, this is it. We're ready to retire, start finding a place to live. And the Air Force comes down and taps me on the shoulder and says, Brett, before you retire, you've got one more job to do. And they sent me to Kabul, Afghanistan for a year to be an advisor to the Afghan Air Force, trying to get them to be able to control, basically operate and run their own military. So I went over there and saw that for a year, came back in 2018, taught for my last year, and was finally able to retire. And we were looking to get back to the East Coast to get back closer to North Carolina without paying North Carolina taxes. So we found Tennessee and specifically Athens. And so we moved here in 2019, got us a nice piece of property with some land out in the Riceville area, and went to fly for the airlines. And then about a year and a half into it, I was with Allegiant in training. I just switched over to Allegiant. And when COVID broke out, we finished training. They sent everybody home and they said, we'll call you when it's time to come back. A year later, they called me to go back not only to work but to training, and they wanted us to move to Cincinnati because the basing situation had changed and all that. So I said, okay, that's not acceptable. We're not going to do that. So I quit and spent the next 2 years in full retirement finally, just staying on the property, working around there, meeting friends and doing projects, doing a lot of clearing, doing a lot of building and that kind of thing. And then one day in Florida, I was on vacation with some friends, and we're sitting on the balcony watching the sun come up, and a good buddy of mine was reading the morning fax, and he said, hey, Brett, you won't believe it, but there's a job opening for the director of the museum. This sounds right up your alley. And I said, the museum? Where's that? And he started telling me I knew about it, and he was telling me more details on it. And that's why I looked into it, and I said, well, I'll put an application. I want to try that out. I want to do that. Being in the military and moving around so much, and any other veteran would probably tell you the same thing, it's very difficult to get a sense of roots because every 3 years you're moving and you're going to be gone. So it's a nomadic lifestyle. It's a lot of traveling. You meet great friends when you first get there, but usually by the second half of your tour, you're still friends with those folks, but you don't really meet new people. Yeah. So because you're about to go. And after being in Athens for about 5 years, 4 or 5 years, I had gotten to know people. I got the sense that being a smaller town, there's a sense of connection. Everybody knows somebody. There's a history here. And all my interactions with people that I've met up to that point was, it's a fertile ground for storytelling. And being in the military, I can sit around and tell stories about the things we've done all day long. But I really appreciated that idea about it. And also, I was very passionate about serving my country through that those 2 decades of active duty. And that, then when I was done, I did have kind of a sense of I need to get back into some kind of service, but not the military kind. And this opportunity just presented itself. It seemed like a blessing. It came out of nowhere, but it was perfect. The more and more I thought about it, it's like, this is what I'm looking for, is to get back into a community, put down those roots, start meeting people, serve a cause, which is education, which I'm doing for the last 10 years, and it was refreshing to get back into that role, but serving in a different way, serving a local community and bringing some of the experiences and the skills that I've had in the past to bear on it, to try to do whatever I can do to help. So they picked me up at the museum, they hired me, and it's been about 5 months now, and it has been a blessing, and I'm really enjoying it, and every day is different. The previous director, Ann, who you have interviewed before, told me that. She said, Brett, I can't really tell you what a typical day looks like because every day is different. And I said, that's perfect. That's the kind of job I'm looking for. So
I can't ask you later, give me a typical day in Brett's life, because it's not there.
Yeah, I can give you several examples of how a typical day differs.
Oh, man. First off, thank you tremendously for that kind of service. I was a 2-year desk jockey in the Air Force in 72 and 3, and my major connection, I was in Homestead, Florida, counseling the young men as they went to Vietnam and coming home from Vietnam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those experiences that can never be on your scale, of course, being active as you were, but it just brought me into the war effort back then that I never would have thought as a doctor you could ever do. Still have friends to this day, thank goodness, that are okay. And then we have so many, as you're well aware, with PTSD, and we'll be doing a program on that fairly soon on behalf of Memorial Day. But wonderful, just some great stories you would have to tell. And then the segue from international relations, teaching at the academy, and small town director of a museum, but it's not small time. It's big time because of all the people that come into the museum, and you've learned that in these 5 months. They're just not Athens. So when you look at that's amazing to have that background, and that the Air Force was willing to progress in your degrees. That's awesome. I think it's great.
I think it's a good, like, I never had this in the Air Force. I never did the same job twice from tour to tour. Same. Everything was completely different, and everything just built on it. It built on the previous assignment, doing something different. So by the time I got to the museum, it seemed like a natural transition.
Now, do you do private plane flying?
I don't. I don't fly anymore. My doctor's a pilot, and there's other people I know that are pilots that are trying to get me back into it. But no, I just don't have the passion for it, to be honest. And that's the honest. And there's money and there's a time issue. But at the same time, it's a lot of work to stay current. And I just got to the point, I think I realized it when I was flying for the airlines. It's not as enjoyable as it used to be. But sometime in the future, if I do get back in flying, it'll probably be buying a small private little plane that I just fly around town with, go up into the mountains, but not to fly commercially or travel in it or anything like that.
Yep. I am what's known as a chicken flyer. I have flown coast to coast, no problem, as long as the plane's big enough, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. I have developed over the last number of years worsening claustrophobia. Uh-huh. I don't like to be in tight spaces. I've never been anxious. I know it sounds crazy, and folks who know me understand, my family and friends and everybody we know here. It's not about, am I going to perish in an airline crash, because we know statistically less likely than driving in Athens, Tennessee, but the reality of the claustrophobia started getting to me. So every time I need to get on a plane, somebody needs to supply me with some sort of beverage. Uh-huh. And I don't mean a Coca-Cola, just to say, Doc, settle down, and I'll be okay. But I can admire you flying. Now, how old are the kids now?
The kids now are 22 and 19. Wow. The 19-year-old turns 20 this summer. The oldest one, Cameron, he is going to school in Cleveland State, the community college here in town. He's going to the Athens Education Center. Good. Athens Education Center, or McMinn, I can't remember the exact title. But he goes to classes out there. The youngest one is a full-time student living in residence at Lee University down in Cleveland. They're both enjoying it. The school's been great. The youngest one's really loving campus life. Good. Yeah, he's stressed out, as every college student is, but he's doing fantastic. I'll brag on him a little bit. He's made Dean's List every semester since he's been there. He's just finishing his second year.
Great university. Yeah. Great place. Yeah. And will they follow international relations or do what your wife
has? Probably not. Probably not. They seem to be on their own path. The oldest one is interested in animal sciences, mm-hmm. and the younger one is interested in basically digital media production. And that's great. I'm not forcing them or encouraging them to go serve in the military or anything, but they can do whatever they like. And they're finding their own way, and their mother and I are totally supportive of whatever decisions they make.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think we all discover that through the years. And now with me having two granddaughters, 26 and 27, and another set, 9 and 11, it's been interesting mm-hmm. to watch their own paths as they form that. Now, in our local museum, a lot of that is dependent on volunteer efforts, as you're well aware. And you have a full-time staff of how many?
We have a full-time staff of 4. Our program director, Charlene Such, is our program director. Office manager is Kim Pierce. And our curator is Betty Catherine Boyd. We have a volunteer, two part-time employees, Joy Simpson and Jubilee Reed. Jubilee writes our Museum Matters article in the DPA. So if you pick up the Daily Post Athenian, she does a beautifully written article where she will single out a single artifact in the museum and give you the background, the history, the background of it, the company that maybe produced it or where it was found, or its role in history, for example. So it's fascinating articles, and I enjoy reading them. So I learn something from her articles every week. Mm-hmm. So there are two part-time employees, and of course our treasurer, who's been a 30-year-long volunteer for the museum, Mr. Tom Biddle, and who you know.
Yes.
And of course we have other volunteers, the Museum Guild itself, which is a group of over 50 ladies, men and women, that volunteer to put on 2 of our fundraising events, which we'll get into here shortly. Mm-hmm. We also have a quilt guild. That's a group of ladies that are passionately devoted to quilting. And they'll hold classes and workshops. And we'll do an annual quilt show every October. So it's a lot of participation from many diverse groups of people in the community that really make the museum run. But the backbone of it, it's not the director, it's the staff. That's one thing I learned very quickly when I came in there, is they make that place hum, and I'm very grateful for it.
My wife and I were fortunate when the museum began to become Life Charter members way, way back when they were over at Tennessee Wesleyan for a while in the original historic old college building, and then as the progression came to where you all are now, just beautiful to watch all of those changes. And you do. You have outstanding board members, volunteers. And this coming week, Brett, let's talk about, I guess, one of the two major fundraisers, and that's the very famous Trash and Treasure Sale. Share with the listeners
certainly.
What they can expect.
Yep, certainly. Yep, like you said, the Trash and Treasure Sale is coming up. Premiere night is on the 24th. That's a ticketed event, so if you buy a ticket, you'll get first crack at the merchandise that's in there. And then 25th through the 27th is the actual sale. It will take place down at the Museum Annex. We purchased a new building a couple of years ago, and the Trash and Treasure Sale predominantly takes place in that building. Throughout the year, local residents will donate items, household goods. It could be anything from furniture to power tools to dolls, to toys, to you name it. If you can think of it, it's probably in the sale. And so we'll hold about a 3-long-day event where local citizens can come in, go to the annex. We'll have people there directing parking and whatnot, and go through and see if there's anything you like. And all the proceeds to the sale go back to the museum. It's a fundraiser. Because again, as a nonprofit, we're reliant upon donations, memberships, grants, sponsorships. That's how we pay the staff. That's how we pay the utilities. And the Museum Guild is one of our predominant fundraising organizations. They are very good at what they do. It's a joy to watch them watch sometimes. And they, all those proceeds, they'll take out any expenses, but the rest of it goes to goes to the museum. It's a wonderful event. It draws a lot of people. So if you're interested, please spread the word, friends and family, not just locally, but if anybody comes from out of town, let them know we have that going on. And with any event at the museum, you can always check our website. It's www.livingheritagemuseum.org. It's org, O-R-G. And it has a list of all of our events. We can talk more about the Heritage School events and the stuff that we do year-round. But you can get all the details for the trash and treasure sale. And we're still open for donations. So if anybody wants to donate anything, starting, I think it's the 22nd, you have to check the website to make sure I'm accurate on that. But we have a receiving week that takes place before the sale. Go to the website, livingheritagemuseum.org, and check the times. And please, if you got anything that you want to give away that you think somebody else might enjoy, what you might think is trash could be someone else's treasure. And all those sales go directly to benefit the museum in our mission on educating and preserving the history of the county.
And watching the folks, like you say, those volunteers put all that together in a form where you just walk in and just purchase it is wonderful, and the people help. They're right there.
That's
helping.
Right.
If you've got something in mind you want to look for.
And if anytime anybody's at the sale and you get to meet some of the guild members, if you feel like you're looking for a volunteer opportunity, talk to them.
Absolutely.
And we'd love to have you on the team. Come join. And it's not a huge time commitment, but except twice a year when they're at their busiest. So they'll cram a year's worth of work in a few weeks every year. But it's a great way to give back to the community, and they're a wonderful group of people.
They certainly are. And the second thing, Brett, is the Holiday House and toward the holiday season, obviously. Mm-hmm. Share with the folks what that consists of.
Holiday House is our second major fundraiser that we do every year. It's in November, closer to the holiday season. What we do is we will bring in, it's a dinner, it's a catered dinner. We use a lower room of the museum, the exhibition hall, and we have a massive dinner, usually about 120 people in attendance. And we do a silent auction. So all the proceeds from the silent auction, of course, goes to the museum. And we also do a live auction. We have an experienced auctioneer comes in, John Fogarty. Most people might know him. And my first major event as I was coming in as director was Holiday House. So I got to see that right off the bat, and what a lot of fun it was. A lot of people there. The food catering was fantastic, and the silent auction was fun. The live auction was something. I've never really attended a live auction before.
Okay. But and with John, you learned.
And with John, you do. And it was a great time. And we encourage everybody, as we get closer to that, we'll start putting more details out. But again, same idea. It's a fundraiser, and all the proceeds go back to the museum.
Now share, too, Brett, because we also have a great time attending, as you're pointing out, some of these Heritage School events or discussions where speakers come in and do wonderful jobs highlighting the history of the area.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. And before we leave Holiday House, I need to put a plug in for the bake sale. I forgot about the bake sale.
Yes, please.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal bake sale. The ladies get together and they bake some of the most wonderful food you've ever seen. And that'll happen right before Holiday House kicks off that same evening.
That's right.
But as far as Heritage School goes, that's a year-round program that we started years ago. What we do is twice a month on Saturdays from about 11 to 1, we'll bring in local artisans, people that are skilled in trades or crafts, traditional crafts and arts and trades that just aren't practiced that much anymore. And they'll teach classes. We'll also have classes. We have one of our part-time workers, Joyce, does an Italian lessons class. She's teaching Italian. So if you want to learn a new language, you can do that. That's been popular. And you'll see the wide variety of what's on there. My first class that I attended, my wife and I went to a quilt barn square painting class where you learned how to paint quilt barn squares. Or barn quilt squares, if I say that. And it's not only is it fun, but you get to create something, and we got to take it home with us, but I got to meet people. And you hear their stories. You like talking to folks and hearing their stories on your podcast, but I learn a lot about people because when they come to the museum. Because it is a museum, but it's also, in a way, a social gathering.
So you know what you need, though.
What's that?
For the wintertime, you need a pot-bellied stove.
Okay.
And you need to serve bologna and cheese sandwiches, which is what a historic place called the True Store used to do. And that's where people came and told stories. And it's down on the Bowater Road.
Okay.
It no longer exists. It's a building sitting there. But I just thought about that one day when I was in the museum and thinking, man, how great this would be. Brett just sets up bologna and cheese sandwiches come by and pay a buck and take one home with you and tell stories, just sit around an old stove.
That's a great idea.
I don't know if that would work inside the museum, the stove, but they could
take we got a patio in the back. So there's a patio out back, so we can...
It just hit me.
But during the trade fair, we have a blacksmith, so I think we can...
You could do that over before.
I think we could do that. That's a good idea. I'll take that back to Charlene. She's probably listening to it, so she's already writing it down.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, in addition to Heritage School, on the last Thursday of every month, we have what's called History for Lunch, and that takes place from 12 to 1, and it's usually a historical presentation. We have a huge library of interviews that we've done with past prominent citizens of Athens or McMinn County. Me and my friend Paul Wilson just got through going through a bunch of World War II veteran interviews that were done. Just he and I sat down and watched some of these, and we will sometimes play an interview. Other times we'll have guest historians, like our Sheriff Guy came in and did a presentation on Star Mountain, the history of Star Mountain and the White Cliffs Hotel up there. That was very popular, brought a bunch of folks out. One of our museum's great supporters, Keith Bester, he did a presentation on his restoration of the Fountain Hill home in Niota, which he bought and purchased 20 years ago and restored it. Very popular there too. I gave a lesson on World War II history on our Charles R. Ware exhibit, the U.S. Navy lieutenant who was lost in the Battle of Midway. So we do things like that. We have a Secret Service agent coming up. It's either History for Lunch or Heritage School. I can't remember which, but it might be Heritage School. But regardless, he's coming to speak about his experience as a Secret Service agent. That's a different topic. So those are also available. And the more interest we get, then the more likely we are to start adding programs. Excuse me. I was just talking to the program director today about doing more than possibly two heritage schools a month, depending on what interest we have. And anybody can go online, like I said, go to the website, and you can see the schedule of events. I think we're scheduled all the way out through the summer and into the fall of this year with programming. So you can find something that's interesting. And in addition, I will ask for all the listeners out there, we have a contact us function on the webpage where you can go down and click the contact us button, and it brings up a little screen where you can type your name, email, and put a message in there. If there are any topics or any trades or any crafts or anything that you would like to have a class in, give us some feedback. Tell us, because we're always looking for new ideas. What else could we do? What new program could we teach on a Heritage School day? But we want to respond to what the community would like to see. Feel free, jump on the website and let us know what you'd like to see, and we'd welcome it. We check that email every day and we'll see what we can do, see if we can find an instructor in that field.
And do you go then to some of our local schools and talk to them, the students, or they come to you?
We do a little mixture of both. During the summer months, there's a program called Kids Connection, and the city gets a grant, and what they'll do is they will foster after school care or during the summer months, if the kiddos' parents are both working and they need some sort of care during the day, then the Kids Connection will help fill that need, and we will interact with that program. So whether the kids come to the museum and they do a tour, or we go there and teach a heritage class or teach something about the museum. I'm not sure how long that program's been going on, but we did it last year or maybe the year before, and we're continuing it again this year. I've already talked with the lady who's organizing that. The school curriculums and timings and all that kind of stuff, it's hard to break away the kids from school for a full day at the museum, but we're working with the Athens City Schools. I've spoken with with Joe Barnett over there about seeing what we can do towards the end of the years after testing is over. And now that the new school is in place, it's only a block away from the museum, so it's easily within walking distance. So in another aspect of the schools is the homeschoolers. We do get a lot of homeschool groups that come through, and we'll give them a tour of the museum. And they're getting educational credit for it as well. So it's beneficial. We're really trying to outreach to the children, get more young folks into the museum, and at least get them introduced to their own county's history.
Do you know yet, Brett, I know you've been there a short time, but how many visitors a year might come through?
Mm-hmm. It varies, but on average, over the years I've looked at the numbers, we average probably anywhere between 15,000 and 18,000 a year. So,
a lot of folks.
Yep. and we're that's pretty good for a small museum. Absolutely. I mean, we're three floors. We've got about 30-plus permanent exhibits and some temporary ones, about five or six of them, that rotate through our Gallery 1 every year. And there's 30,000 artifacts. 12,000 artifacts. And so that's a lot to see. And even if you've been to the museum once before, you're only going to take in maybe a tenth of it. Exactly. I've been there for 4 months, and I work there every day, and I learn something new.
Yeah.
It's something as interesting as a thread dispenser that came out of the general store from a small town that is now 60 feet under Watts Bar Lake, because when they put the dam up, it flooded the town. But that little thread dispenser that came out of the general store somehow was retained and donated to the museum, so we have that little piece of history there. So you're not just learning about a single artifact, you're learning about the greater context of the historical period where it came from, the changes that took place in the area over time, and how it impacted the communities.
Are you saying, Brett, just separate from the museum, and I was talking to another guest a few weeks ago, we're seeing maybe not as much interest in local history from our kids. Maybe they don't, as that guest said, they don't dive deeply enough into their local history. And it came up in the question of how do we let our kids know some of our background? In other words, Dad, can you tell me about your father or your grandfather? Right. A lot of that history does not get transmitted to the youngsters, and suddenly they're turning around and looking and saying, boy, I didn't know my grandmother or anything about her. I see a few pictures, but I know nothing about her. Are you seeing that personally within this context, maybe, of maybe not wanting to know as much about it? It's interesting to come see exhibits, but if you're following what I'm saying, it's just, are they interested enough to do a deeper dive into some of the books and research and stuff?
I think so. I think some of them are, not all of them. We had two high school students that came in to do like a job shadow program with us about a week or two ago, and they really enjoyed it. And I gave them a tour of the museum, and I told them some stories. It was storytelling. I think if you make it, if you make history at least engaging and interesting, give them something that you can illuminate the unique nature of your given region's past or whatnot, instead of just reading off dates and facts and figures of stuff that happened, which is unfortunately how history is often taught in schools, or at least used to be. I think teachers are getting really good at being creative in the classroom these days. You can bring them in, you can draw them in. I think not just kids, but I think everybody. We live day to day with a lot of distractions in our lives. I'll quote Dr. Phil, like 2008, it seems like a bunch of cargo planes flew over the country and dropped cell phones everywhere. And it changed a lot. And it changed a lot. But that's technology, I think, that you could harness. I mean, we have a website. Most places have websites. We have an Instagram page. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. So we try to get that information out there using these new forms of communication, try to take advantage of that technology. And maybe that will introduce at least the knowledge of the museum to younger kids and younger generations.
Which would be great, because, and prior to me starting podcasting and with our mutual friend Jack Allen, realizing I'd never listened to one prior to December of 22. I knew what they were. I wasn't ignorant, but I discovered in my research the largest podcast listening group is between the ages of around 14 to 15 to 35. That doesn't mean Brett and Shelley don't listen to a podcast, but what we're saying is, and Jack and I have tried to develop an older audience for what we're trying to do some medical, do a lot of these general interviews. But this has become a humongous source of information for a different generation.
That's right.
Suddenly, I'll just punch this, and hopefully it's all honest stuff.
Right.
Well, we all know that argument for another podcast. But,
but
the reality is, looking at it, and then newspaper industry, when I was writing a column, we had pretty good subscribers, and then little by little, and as the paper goes from daily to three times a week, and you lose subscribers. To me, the museum then actually seems to be just a wonderful place that they can engage not just the history, but like you say, some of this current information, talking about things as well that makes sense. Now, as you progress in your role, and I always like to ask my guests this, what do you see? I know y'all have plans with the board. You look at 3-year plans, 5-year plans, and all of that. But what does Brett see as something you would like for the museum to be doing, say, in the next 2 to 3 years? You mentioned programming, mm-hmm. but do you see some other bigger things, maybe additions to the space or anything else? I'm not trying to put you on the mm-hmm. spot, but what do you think?
Our immediate goal, I'd say, if you have a five-year plan, the short-term target is to try to get, like we were just talking about, we're trying to get younger folks involved and interested in the museum. We have a phenomenal foundation of support from our current members and our members. We have a heritage club. Those are folks that give larger amounts of money, and they've been phenomenal with the museum, and we rely on their support. And what we want to do is take that sense of community and that sense of ownership that they have for the museum and share it and try to get it out to a different generation. 10, 20 years down the road, we can maintain that core of not just support for the museum, but a core of an interest and appreciation and a preservation of the history of the county. Because if you don't care for it, if you don't cultivate that, it'll die. And eventually in the future, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, the goal is obviously to have the museum thriving as much and even more than it is on any given day. That's the short-term goal, is the outreach. And we're taking some initiatives with social media, doing podcasts like this one, doing Instagram, because that's a younger demographic that follows on Instagram. So we're just trying, it's just outreach, just getting the word out, letting people know. And make the museum not just a place where you go and just learn history, but it's a place that you go and learn more about your community and about the people that live in it and that you live amongst. And that's could be a hard sell for younger folks, because they're young, they're ambitious, they're looking to start their lives, and that's where their focus is. And but here and there, if we can capture some of that interest, and at least maybe when they come back to Athens, when they're later on in their lives, they'll remember the impact the museum might have had on them when they were a kid, and they'll say, I think I'll go back there and volunteer. I might give a donation to the museum this year or join as a member.
Great idea. So, and I have been back 47 years now. Mm-hmm. My wife grew up here. I started college in 63 at Westland, so it's always been hometown to me, second hometown. But it's interesting that you're saying that, because how many young people I have watched who say, oh, I can't wait to leave. Mm-hmm. Athens is a small town. I need to really spread my wings and live. Right. Yeah. And then a number of them, folks that you would have met, come back home. Mm-hmm. And really serve the community well through the organizations like the museum and library, arts center, places like that. And it's just phenomenal with that. Tell the folks what you enjoy doing to just take a breather from your work. I know what you enjoy doing.
Yeah, it's running out of time. But ever since I was a teenager, I played guitar, musician. I call myself a quote-unquote musician. I don't play enough.
Professional or just musician, there's a difference.
Yeah, there is. Yes, I'm not a professional, that's for sure. I've been a guitar player since I was a teenager. And, every now and then, I used to get together with some friends up in Knoxville. We had a little informal band. We'd get together and play on the weekend. And you and I have talked about maybe getting together and doing something here locally. I'll have to break out the guitar and shake off some of the dust. It's been about a year or so since I've really played. But so I do that. And also spend time. I've got a good-sized piece of property, which keeps me busy. I actually enjoy working outdoors and mowing 11 acres of grass. And I've got a pond, and I go fishing out there. That's a good, quiet place to relax. And of course, I'm still an avid reader. So just kicking my feet up on the deck on a nice spring day and reading a book is hobby enough for me. So.
And to read, I'm with you. I've been blessed since I was a kid, just read anything I could get my hands on. Mm-hmm. It could be classics, it could be some fiction, nonfiction, it doesn't matter. Just grab a book, sit down. Kindle's a great thing. My interview with Rebecca Coleman at the library, and she says, it's okay, I still love a book. Kindle's great. Get people reading, get the youngsters reading.
Yep.
But it's just, I got to have the book in my hand and studying that. And I think, folks, that you can tell that Brett's got a passion for this, and it's just so exciting. And I'd love for you all to go to the website and be able to see what our museum is doing. Come and volunteer. As he says, a couple hours here, a couple hours there. Please show up for this coming week with the Trash and Treasure Sale. Big support. And you're going to find some great things. I've donated things to them over the years and have gone and purchased things. But as Brett's saying, you get to meet some people sometimes you may not have met, and the folks that are helping. So it's just awesome. And as we get toward Holiday House, I'll probably get you back on the program. We can promo that. Maybe by that time we will have sat down and played a little music. Yeah. Get our mutual friend Jim Brooks in here and do a little bit of this. But
we can get some of it on tape and you can create some intro music.
Absolutely. And my friend that I interviewed yesterday plays guitar all the time. He says, well, why don't we just do a podcast with nothing but music? Just introduce a song, sit down, and we all sit around and play, and then let the listeners say, what is that song? And we don't even have to sing it. We can just play it.
That's a great idea.
I just think, hey, looking for ideas for podcasts. Yeah. But no, any other things you want to say to the listeners at this point before we wrap it up?
I guess the last thing I'd say is just encourage everyone just to come down and visit. We do have annual memberships. We do have heritage clubs where you can sign up and give a little bit larger amount of money to keep them, to support the museum. But don't make that decision until you come see us. I think you'll be pleased. You'll be pleasantly surprised at how great the museum is for a small town. And the amount of artifacts there we have and the facility itself and the presentation of it, it blows me away every time I walk through there. Come introduce yourself. Come find me. I'm usually around there somewhere. I like to roam the building, and I'll give you a tour. I'll walk around, give you the history of the building itself and the artifacts that are in it. And if you like it and you want to support it, memberships are $45 a year for families, $25 for individuals, and we have senior and military and student discounts as well. We'd love to have you out there. Just if you share that passion for history and you want to learn a little bit more about it, or you never really gave it a second thought, come down and see us. I'd love to meet you.
I think that's awesome. And folks, Brett was so kind when I first met him to listen to me go on. As you all know, I'll talk a post on the ground. And then when he agreed to come, I was just tickled and so delighted to have you today. And I'll be seeing you at the museum sale. Whether I buy anything, hopefully I will buy something to support, but at least you come by and just visit. But thank you so much. And folks, as we always say, want you to have a safe and healthy day, and I'll see you further up the road.